Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Dave, I've got a stat warning for you.
Good.
In the light of a conversation we were having only yesterday about puns that we never got at the time.
Oh, yes.
Sandy Shaw, Perry Farrell. We'd forgotten that. Perry Farrell, meaning
I never knew that.
I'd forgotten that. Faye Fife, we didn't realise that was a pun. Pete Brickett. So in the light of that, Kimono My House by Sparks came out exactly 50 years ago this month. And which was a pun, which I never realised till quite recently. There was a pun on the 1951 Toe Tapper by Rosemary Clooney, Come On to My House. You knew this, didn't you?
Well, I did, actually, in that case, because I do remember thinking, oh, yeah, that's Come On Over My House, yeah. But I didn't specifically relate it to Rosemary Clooney. I just thought, oh, it's a well-known phrase of saying kind of thing. But anyway,
exactly. Yeah. It could be, yeah. But in the spirit, yeah, of great punning album titles, Electric Landlady, Rubber Soul, Aladdin Sane, Ruth is Stranger Than Richard, and some not so great ones. I've got a few punning titles here, one of which isn't real. The rest are real. Okay,
this
you
is a
have
good
to
idea.
Spot the ringer. Okay.
Yeah.
So, was there an album by Public Enemy called New World Odor?
Oh, right. My goodness. Wow.
Okay. Was there a record called Lead Me Not Into Penn Station by Block? Was there a record called A Whole Lalo Schifrin going on? Yes, there was.
There was. I know
that. We know that. Okay. You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish.
That's a real record. That's Frank Zappa's.
REO Speedwagon.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah. Road to Rouen. By Supergrass.
That's real.
Okay. Oral and Hearty. That's a weird one, isn't it? By Motion Worker, the jazz musician. Oral and Hearty, as in Laurel and Hardy. I mean, you forget Oral and Hearty. Okay. Yourself is Steam by Mercury Rev. Okay. Funk Shui by John Oates. This is one I want not to be true, actually. The Berry Vest of Gilbert O'Sullivan. It is real. There's an awful cover with, as you can imagine, with a sort of T-shirt with, I don't know, berries on it. And lastly, The Horse Foreman of the Apocalypse, Bruce Dickinson solo album, which he's bellowing into the microphone on the cover. So one of those isn't real.
Well, I know immediately which one isn't real, but I'm grateful to be apprised of the ones I didn't know of and reminded of the ones that I did know of. But I happen to know the one that isn't real is The Horse Foreman of the Apocalypse, because I know that's a headline you wrote many years ago.
Golden Oyer wrote. Yeah.
Golden Oyer.
Led Zeppelin. It's good, isn't it?
It's a good one. And
that's
you,
true.
You carried it around looking for a place to use it.
And I've finally
in the
found
40
it.
Years since, and you've finally found it. So congratulations.
I've got to mention Saxon Violins. Saxon Violins by Blind Justice. I have to say that I think Lead Me Not Into Penn Station by Block is a genuinely good album title. I love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you remember that book? There's a book I always used to see in bookshops, which I always used to stand there and muse over and never read, called By Grand Central Station I Sat Down and Wept. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
I always found that very... just a very engaging idea.
It's fantastic.
Never went any further. Never read it. I can't remember who it's by.
You want to know why and why there?
Yeah, so, it was just one of those titles that, that caught my fancy. So anyway, well done with your stamp.
You won.
I did. For what it's worth, I don't suppose they get a major cash prize. I don't suppose they get a fridge magnet in the shape of the Parthenon in Athens, do I?
Which is what we're giving away to our quiz contestants this month. Worth having, I'm going to tell you.
Absolutely, definitely. So Duane Eddy passed away. Kind of a major figure in popular music, and I seem to recall just before the Beatles, in that kind of that period where also Roy Orbison held sway. You know what I mean?
I can remember, it's one of my first memories.
Oh, go on.
Peter Gunn. Now, I can remember Peter Gunn being on the radio because it was such a memorable track, wasn't it? Dum 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 dum, and that horn sound, and having never heard anything like that in my life, and I probably don't remember it when it came out because I was 4 or 5 or whatever. But certainly the end of the '50s or the early '60s, I really do remember that song. I remember that playing in little cafes in the high road.
Yeah,
fantastic sound.
It's sound, isn't it? And that's the kind of the key thing, isn't it? You know that. That's what you realise when you look at the whole sweep of popular music over kind of our lifetimes, if you like, our very long lifetimes. That's the big change, is the change from song to sound, isn't it? It's from performance to record. And Duane Eddy always used to say this, that he was interested in sound, not anything else, you know. And so he had this very specific sound, didn't he? It's not a bass, is it?
No.
He's just playing the bottom strings, basically, of a guitar. Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's how he distinguished himself. Whereas, you know, Hank Marvin or The Ventures or Les Paul or, you know, the other kind of people who were known for the guitar at the time were tended to play at the top of the range, didn't they? Whereas his was always the kind of stern, stirring, kind of cowboy sound, wasn't it? It was a sound that made you think of the great outdoors, you know. You were galloping across the Western Plain.
It was. And didn't he finish up in cowboy films? When he was in a film called The Wild Westerners, wasn't he?
Oh, was he really? I didn't know that.
Okay. Playing the part of Deputy Marshal Clint Fallon. So that little fantasy actually came true. But I think you're right, because around that time, I think it was to do with the fact that people were no longer sitting there, you know, as they did in the mid-50s, listening to those records on the radio, listening to them on their gramophones or whatever. They're actually going out and they were seeing those bands. So it was about a sound and a look, wasn't it? It was about rock and roll, R&B, skiffle particularly. It was about a particular sound, wasn't it? It's not.
But also, I don't know anybody else in popular music, and I stand to be corrected if anybody's coming up with a rebuttal here. I don't know anybody whose sound was so clearly marketed in fact, it had a one-word descriptor, which was twang.
Twang. I just had a look at the
twangy
album titles.
And so yeah, the shorthand for referring to Duane Eddy in the late 50s and 60s became, he's the man with the twang, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so... 9 out of 10 of his album titles seem to major on the fact that the amount of twang.
I've got them up here, actually.
Go on, what have you got?
Twangy guitar will travel.
Perfect.
The twang's the thing. Twisting and Twanging. Which I've just found a copy of in the attic, which is a kind of crossover classic, isn't it? It's Twist and Twang. I've written both markets. Genius. There's Twangy Guitar, Silky Strings, Twang a Country Song, Twanging Up a Storm, Twanging the Golden Hits, Twangsville, the biggest twang of all, and the Roaring Twangies, my favourite. And the compilations were $1 million worth of twang. There were two volumes of that.
There were, yeah.
Yeah. 20 terrific twangies. Twangy Peaks, amazing. Twang Thang, the Duane Eddy anthology, and Twangin' from Felix to L.A. That drives home the point.
That really sounds like a kind of stack waddy game in the making, doesn't it? Really?
It is.
Which of those is made up? Because already out of that list, I thought some of those sound as if they've been cooked up. Some of those sound like internet pastiches, you know.
Yeah, the roaring twangies.
The roaring twangies. But have you also, I tried to send you a picture of this morning.
Oh, I saw it, yeah.
In 1965, he made Duane Eddy Does Bob Dylan, you know, which is instrumental versions of Bob Dylan songs. And the cover... This is 1965, so this is just a few months after Bob Dylan's put out Bringing It All Back Home, which, as we discussed recently on the podcast, was the kind of the first of those sort of lifestyle-y presentations on covers. And the Duane Eddy Does Bob Dylan, if you haven't seen this, go and have a look at it. It's absolutely classic.
It's fantastic.
Some designer has been hired to kind of put Duane in some sort of bohemian context, which is not Duane Eddy's natural, you know, area at all. And so there he is, sitting very uncomfortably perched on a number of scatter cushions. And there's got not one beautiful woman, but two beautiful women with him in the picture, one of whom... He's perched on what appears to be an agonizing piece of kind of modern furniture. Isn't that right?
It is.
And the other one on the left she's made up to look like Juliet Greco. She's looking at a rose while poring over a number of books, all of which have the title Wisdom. So that's the idea so nothing more perfectly characterizes the shift that took place in popular music in the mid-60s, from kind of, you know, we all chase the simple pleasures of cars and girls and soda pop and twisting and so forth, to know we're suddenly all indoors studying the wisdom of the ages and thinking profound thoughts. Nothing catches that better than Duane Eddy Does Bob Dylan. And also the very idea of instrumental versions of somebody who is... primarily known by many people as being all about the words, is a kind of funny idea. Didn't this come up recently when Bob Dylan was nominated for his Nobel Prize for Literature? I think he said this at some point. I've read a quote.
What did he say?
Well, he said something about, you know, people go on about the words, but I think, you know, I'd like to be recognised for the other things I do. So, and I think he said I was very pleased that Duane Eddy did a record of my songs, of my tunes. He pointed this out at some stage, you know. So you imagine it's the kind of thing that sticks in Bob Dylan's mind.
But also, it was trying to make the point, wasn't it, at the time that pop music had, you know, fathomless depth.
Oh, well, that cover
it wasn't this superficial thing that the parents' generation thought it was, you know, that it was deep and it was meaningful.
And of course, Duane Eddy was, you know, brought back into the public mind with that kind of Art of Noise reworking.
They did a reworking of Peter Gunn, didn't they? And also he made a record, I'd forgotten this, he made a record with Richard Hawley not that long ago.
Oh, he did.
They wrote 18 songs in 11 days or something, didn't they?
He did.
Those lovely things that just, what a perfect marriage, the two of them. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Because Richard Hawley's act is very derived from Duane Eddy. Yeah. That's brilliant.
So anyway, the other thing this week, I've been going through a Little Feat stage this week.
Oh, nice.
And I was playing Feet Don't Fail Me Now and you know, Dixie Chicken and all these records that they made in the, 74, 75, that kind of period. And I realized I didn't have a CD copy of Feats Don't Fail Me Now, or if I have, I've lost it. And it's just ridiculous, Mark. I shouldn't be like this. I've got millions of records, millions. But if I get obsessed with something and I can't find it, it drives me mad. I almost can't sleep. I think it's got to be here somewhere in the house. Where could I put it? You know, because mainly it's in alphabetical order, but there's piles here, there's piles there, or whatever.
And there's that terrible temptation. You could just buy it again.
Well, let me tell you.
You could just click on something for 99 pence or whatever. There.
No, I couldn't wait that long. I went into town, and as we're going past FOP in Covent Garden, I go in there and I look for CD Feats Don't Fail Me. And I've got the record, obviously, and so forth, but and they haven't got it. But what they have got is this, Mark. They've got holds up a little box on Zoom call here, a little box where you get five Little Feet albums.
Wow.
Little Feet, Sailing Shoes, Dixie Chicken, Feats Don't Fail Me Now, and the last record album for how much, Mark?
It's going to be so ridiculous, like £3.20 or something.
£15. Okay.
Oh, God, that's unbelievable.
£15 for five
albums.
So I thought, well, I got to do
God,
that.
God, they're good records.
They're just insanely good. And, you know, it is a classic case of, you know, how you've just got to get on the wavelength of music, and it doesn't always strike you. Of course, I've loved Little Feet since, you know, 72, 73 or whatever. But I can go through whole years and not listen to them at all. But this week, I put a few of these things on. I also put on Robert Palmer's Pressure Drop, which they played on. They were the band on.
Yeah.
And I just played these records round and round. And I had one of those moments where I just utterly reconnected with them, you know what I mean? And they're
one of
just
the most exciting things I've ever
absolutely
seen.
Absolutely extraordinary.
Little Feet in 1977. Unforgettable.
Oh, they're just ridiculous. And it's a strange thing. Is looking at the sleeves of the old records. And the sleeves were all and Little Feet lived their life in, you know, when Lowell George was alive, because he left and then he died in 79, I think. But they were just chaotic during that period, 74, 75. And you can read the level of chaos on the covers of these records. Because loads of the time, there's like the lyrics of a song are placed on the back of the record, and then they're crossed through with a handwritten note says, maybe next time. You know what I mean? Because they were just changing their mind. And Spanish Moon, which I think is arguably their greatest record, with a brilliant horn arrangement by Van Dyke Parks. In fact, produced by Van Dyke Parks. And Lowell George wanted him to produce the whole album, but Warner Brothers wouldn't let it because they knew how much money Van Dyke Parks spent on records. But anyway, Spanish Moon, which is the jewel of, you know, Feats Don't Fail Me Now, it's not on the cover. It's not on the cover at all. I thought, am I forgetting something? Have I got this wrong? And then of course, there it is. It's on the record. It's listed on the label copy, and it's on the record. It's the last track on the first side, but it's not on the cover at all. You know, they changed their mind. Anyway, one thing I've found on this on Lowell George's sleeve notes, because he always did the sleeve notes for these things, Feats Don't Fail Me Now, where he goes through what each member of the band plays. I think he's credited as guitars, vocal, cowbell. That's all he does, cowbell, you know. But then he says, Kenny Gradney, bass. And then he says, do not take lightly this bit of musicianship one dismisses simply as bass, which I think to myself, what a profound
truth that is.
How true that is, you know. And because we, you know, when people used to revere bass players, which they only did occasionally, because the kind of flash Harrys of rock bands were always guitar players or maybe keyboard players or maybe even drummers, but bass players not so much. the only people that are revered were people like Jack Bruce, you know what I mean, who were kind of very busy.
Or there was show-offs. Jaco Pastorius, Flea, people like later on.
Absolutely.
So I don't think of that as being the kind of, those aren't the great bass players. Great bass players are the ones in the background doing a lot of heavy lifting, but very, very surreptitiously and unobtrusively.
It's also I've never played in a band. I don't know. You have. But that's the way it always kind of seems to me. You know, like I've said to you before, I always think that one of the brilliant things about the Beatles was that the most accomplished musician played the bass. They made him play the bass. He didn't want to play the bass, but they made him play the bass. And so the only reason to do that, Brian Wilson in the Beach Boys, same thing. The only reason to do that is you recognize that a great bass player makes the band more than the sum of its parts. You know, it pulls the thing together. It's kind of adhesive quality,
McCartney,
isn't it?
McCartney, pretty much the best example, do you think?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
It's foundation, he's the propulsion of it, he's the energy, he's the counterpoint, he's the melody. If you look at songs like Come Together or Something or A Day in the Life, it's absolutely transformed by what he does. Incredible.
Yeah, and
greatest bass line, surely Aston Barrett on the Burning album's original recording of I Shot the Sheriff. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I can remember hearing that the first time and thinking, I've never heard anything like it, because it underpins the song, but it also kind of leads from the front and back and has little rhythms and little melodies that nobody else is playing. It's ridiculous. And it's rubbery, and it's bouncy, and it's tuneful. It's phenomenal.
And, of course, nobody... in fact, the overwhelming majority of people just don't notice it at all. Whereas there's a great tradition in entertainment of people applauding things that are ostentatiously, that are kind of showy. You know, it's like... You know, it's like people think the greatest acting is Daniel Day-Lewis or whatever, you know. It's not.
No, it's an understatement.
It's understatement all the time.
It's selflessness.
It's doing hardly anything at all.
Yeah.
But you know, recognizing that has a value for the bigger picture, you know. But the bass players are the kind of the representative of that way of doing things in popular music, aren't they? You know, whereas everybody, there's a great tendency in people's view in any kind of art. The people applaud when there appears to be a lot of something. You know, well, what's a great drummer? Oh, it's a drummer who drums a lot. No, it's not. It's a drummer who does probably the bare minimum. You know what I mean? It's the same in football or anything like that. You know, who are the great players? You know, they're the people who are doing the heavy lifting down the back. You know, that the people in the team recognize. You're just
applauding flash, aren't you? And dexterity.
Yeah.
Another great one, James Jamerson's "You Can't Hurry Love." It's a fantastic bass.
It is.
Oh my God. It switches just before you expect it to switch, and he's got that brilliant thing of a lightness of touch, but also an immense weight about it. It's really heavy, and yet it skips and swings. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah, it is.
Probably invented that morning, you know.
Oh yeah, possibly. But yeah, so you know, as Lowell George says, do not take lightly this bit of musicianship one dismisses simply as bass. Wise words.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I noticed there's a special edition of Smash Hits has just been published about Taylor Swift. And I couldn't work out if that was a good idea or a bad idea, actually. But, I mean, it did interest me because somebody had posted something recently about Select magazine, saying how they loved Select magazine's poster section. You remember it had that 16-page central section called Images, where you got your pictures of Carter or whoever it was, or Blur, or the Pulp Fiction cast or whatever. And I was thinking, I wonder if there was still a market for the posters. There must be. Because if you're a Taylor Swift fan, where would you get pictures of her to put on your bedroom wall?
That's true.
So I thought, you know, everything, your relationship with her really is entirely digital, isn't it? You don't have pictures you can kind of pin up. So I thought it was quite a good idea. I mean, the fact that it's Smash Hits is neither here nor there, really, because anybody interested in Taylor Swift would have been born after Smash Hits closed and have no idea what it was. And there wouldn't be any kind of house style or humour or any of that kind of stuff. But it just interested me, and I just wondered if there was still a market for posters.
Well, it's interesting because only this week I was reading Colin Morrison. It's a guy I know, and Colin's worked in and around magazine publishing for a long time. He does a very good industry kind of tip sheet newsletter called Flashes and Flames. And his big thing this week is about the growth of what are known in the trade as bookazines.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, they've been around for about 20 years or something, but apparently they're doing quite well. And sometimes they're branded using the kind of umbrella of a well-known title like Smash Hits or Good Housekeeping or something like that. But they don't have to be. And they're very often, you know, about people wishing to kind of mark or celebrate their enthusiasm for something at a particular time. And so a lot of it's about timing, about getting the title out into the shops or wherever you put it at the right time. And so a lot of these things tend to be royal related or, you know, major coronations or royal weddings or whatever. They might also be around big sporting achievements or triumphs. You know, if somebody wins the Super Bowl in the States and they haven't done it in years or whatever, you might be able to do really well out of
one-offs, isn't it? Adam Ant one-offs, you know, when he was really big.
Yeah, but also I don't know what the price of the Taylor Swift one is, but I would guess it's fairly high, you know, because there's no point in it not being high. You know, there's kind of no point in
if anybody wants it, they want it badly, you know.
Talking of magazine prices, I've got a piece about Richard and Linda Thompson that in the new issue of the New Statesman.
I saw.
Which is a weekly. I went and bought it. How much, Mark? How much?
New Statesman, my God, it's going to be a lot, isn't it, rather than a little. I mean, it's probably going to be something like 8 or 9 quid.
Well, it was nearly 6 quid.
It's a lot.
Which I thought, that's for a weekly.
That's, I know.
But, you know, I suppose that's kind of fair enough. That's the economics. That's what you have to do, you know. So Taylor Swift, you would have even said, I'm kind of surprised that they haven't happened earlier, those things, you know. Because if you look back, you know, the late Felix Jennings, who we both knew, you know, and Felix did well loads of things.
He did well out of one-shots, didn't he?
Computer magazines and one-shots. Yeah. One-shots. And Bruce Lee was the beginning of his huge one-shot golden streak, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. And he had just ruthless, cold commercial edge about it, which I now rather admire, but my naive and rather romantic younger self used to find it a bit irksome. I remember when John Lennon died, he just put the call out to everybody, said, in now, come on, we're going to do a one-shot. Everyone was still weeping and sitting in a ring of candles. Nah, forget all that. Come on, just bang it out. You get the pictures. I'll bang out some captures. It'll be in the shops tomorrow lunchtime, you know.
That's, I suppose, the golden rule of successful one-off or bookazine publishing is
speed.
You've got to suggest it at the point when most people think it's too early.
Yeah.
Because that's the time to do it. If you wait until absolutely everybody thinks it's a great idea, you've probably waited too long. You know, somebody else has got in there. So talking of magazines, when you say Paul Burke, friend of the podcast, got in touch recently, what's he got? He's got a full set of
Well, the first 50 words, I think it is, which he doesn't want to throw away. But Mrs. Paul Burke, I think, is suggesting they're taking up too much space. So he was saying that if anybody wanted any, just get in touch with us, actually.
Get in touch with us.
Word in your attic website, whatever, email address, and just let us know which ones you're looking for. And he is volunteering to go to the post office and post them to people.
Which is very generous.
Incredibly generous of him.
Now, I think we should make this clear at this point. I think he's only talking about UK postage.
Yes.
Would anybody in Australia think that you can afford to post it out there? In other media news, I meant to talk to you about this. I've got in front of me a piece from The Times, Hugo Rifkind reviewing Jeremy Clarkson's Farm, which I think is returned
for
a new series. He's got a headline which I thought was really good, and I wonder what you thought of this. He said, "I would watch Jeremy Clarkson boil an egg," and the whole thing is about, you know, like him or loathe him, it just doesn't matter, you know, because he has this utter genius for being able to just do things on camera that most people can't do, and have you watch it, you know. And he has, hasn't he? You know,
unbelievable! I think, you know, no matter what you may not agree with all the things he represents. That's not the point. I can remember him being the first person I ever heard who used the expression, "I said that out loud," didn't he?
Oh yes, yes.
Just a brilliant guy.
He did.
You say something ridiculous, then you look at the camera guiltily. You know, I've still never seen that program, the Diddly Squat thing, but apparently it's incredibly funny. And the big star is the 25-year-old
Caleb, or whatever he's called.
That's right, the farmer. That's right.
But I haven't seen it either, and I'm sure it's really good. You know, because I know how good he is. You know,
yeah.
It's just him and a camera. He knows how to do it. You know, and anybody out there who thinks that's easy, go and have a go.
Yeah,
it really is not easy at all. He just has remarkable talent for doing it. And when you consider that, you know, for the most of his first bit of his career, he didn't do it at all. You know, because he was a magazine journalist, wasn't he? Right, I can remember.
Yeah, he was.
He used to be the guy. I used to see him at Doos, you know, because he used to write a column in Performance Car, I think he did. And that was before he was on telly. And so that side of him was only discovered relatively late in life. And he appears to have done rather well out of it.
In other media news, are you following the story of Co-op Arena? Isn't it extraordinary?
Oh, my God.
How does that happen? I can understand you saying, look, the venue isn't ready, so the gigs we've got in 2 weeks' time or whatever won't be able to happen, and we're going to switch to another venue for your tickets or whatever. But the idea that there were people queuing up, I think, that night to go and see an actor and then told them they had to go. Those people travelled into Manchester, teenagers, who then had to get home.
Something was cancelled at 10 minutes' notice. It was just, I mean, you say you can understand, you know, a venue not being able to open. Well, all right, but can you think of any examples of it ever happened in your lifetime where that has occurred? Can't think of any at all. And, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, in most respects, the world is more efficient now than it's ever been in the past, isn't it? You know, there's more planning systems about everything, and everything's more organized than it used to be, isn't it? I think it kind of has to be. And therefore, the idea that this can happen on this scale is absolutely staggering.
It's astounding. Also, we have no indication of what it actually is that is.
Well,
the
it's kind of it's safety and dinner, and clearly those things have got to be thought about. I mean, they had a practice gig, didn't they, to test safety?
Did they?
I think they did something. Yeah, it's about 2 weeks ago or something now. But also that all these gigs were lined up to be in there and haven't been able to. And it's Peter Kay, isn't it? It's
Noel Gallagher,
it's
big
people,
And big people who you've never heard of, like Boogie Widow Hoodie.
Yes.
I don't know about you, Dave. See, that's another interesting thing. But the world of pop music, how narrow it's become, that Boogie Widow Hoodie, who I literally know nothing about,
yes,
is big enough to play this. I can't remember how big this arena is. It's gigantic, isn't it? 15,000 or something. I thought I'm just idly going to Google Wembley Arena and see who's playing at Wembley Arena. Various people playing at Wembley Arena in the near future include Five Finger Death Punch, who I have just about heard of, actually. Kiz Daniel and Full Band. Don't know who Kiz Daniel is. Moneybag Yo and Da Baby. And Trippie Redd. Now, I'm sorry. That's amazing that these people have become so huge that they can play an 8,000-seater venue, and I don't know anything about them. O2 Arena has a group called Cigarettes After Sex playing. I mean, O2 Arena is enormous, isn't it?
Are they playing the big room?
No, that's
there.
The big one. That's the big one. No, because I noticed that Kim Wilde was playing. I think Kim Wilde was playing the O2. She's actually playing the Indigo.
You're
so
right.
So that's the little tiny one. No, this is the big one. I mean, it's astonishing, really. So the whole world has become, that whole pop world is so kind of narrow and self-contained, isn't it? You can just be enormous in your own little world and have no
and not famous at all.
Absolutely.
I'm going to tell you a funny story, and I'm going to cross my path this week, and I'm going to tell you this without naming the individuals concerned. As a guy I know lived around the corner, we went to the pub the other night, and his son is. Is a kind of rapper, and he's got a following, doesn't live in the UK, lives overseas and so forth. And he was coming home, he's doing a few shows, doing a festival or whatever, doing this, doing that. And how's it going? Oh, he's going all right, he's got a fan following, very devoted fan following. And he's his other interest is tattoos. In the sense that he started learning how to apply tattoos, and he started. He also does illustration work, and so he does. He started doing illustrations for tattoos, which fans could buy and then have turned into a tattoo. This has now moved on, Mark. So his next step is. He's going to offering the service that he will tattoo fans. Yes?
My Lord.
So that's autographs taken to an incredible pitch, isn't it?
That's absolutely extraordinary.
Isn't that extraordinary? This is a guy.
Permanent marker.
It's Joni Mitchell, like tattoos, all that kind of stuff. I thought that this is where it's going, isn't it? In
that
the future,
amazing.
All right, I'll do it. This much for a selfie, this much for an autograph, and this much for a tattoo. I'll do some special piece of work for you. Absolutely extraordinary.
That is amazing.
Wouldn't have happened in my day.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Every now and again, I read a piece in the American press, in the New York Times or Washington Post or whatever, about the troubles that appear to be coming down the line for the artist formerly known as Puff Daddy. And every time I get halfway through this and I just have to take a rest and I have to get in touch with you and say, Mark, have you read this?
It is bewildering.
It's just, None of this has come to court yet, but there's a number of charges.
There are five lawsuits pending.
Five lawsuits pending.
What do they involve? They involve the employment of sex workers, I think, good point. I mean, it's just bacchanalia, is it?
It's trafficking, is the word.
Trafficking, that's it. Violence and assault and, oh, my God. But that piece mentions a kind of parallel with Great Gatsby, and it's the idea of this kind of bacchanalian excess. You used to have these things called white parties where everybody dressed in white, didn't they? And you look at the people who were there, who are keeping very quiet now. Martha Stewart, Donna Karan, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Henry Kissinger.
Howard Stern. Who's that?
Henry Kissinger.
Henry Kissinger, that's right.
It is. I mean, because basically what happened in the 90s is a Puff Daddy comes along and has a kind of genius for marketing hip-hop rap stars to a kind of wider world. You know, it's not subcultural. It's from the subculture absolutely into the mainstream. And what goes along with it is a celebration of conspicuous wealth, glamour, youth, sex appeal, fashion, all the things that the world, and particularly the world around New York, absolutely adores. You know, yeah. What I mean, it's that whole Met Gala society.
It's a celebration of the young and the fabulous. East Coast, isn't it? And New York celebration. We're in the greatest place on the planet.
So he became the prime cheerleader for that kind of thing. You know, he was always associated with this kind of thing. You know, he was swigging Cristal, straight out of the bottle. You know, he even had at one point, didn't he have a butler whose job it was to hold an umbrella over his head when he was on the beach at Cannes? You know what I mean?
Right.
It was like,
do you remember the butler's name? It was something like Bunsworth Smythe.
Something like that.
They just
that.
Gave him a kind of double-barreled name to make it sound butlerish. It was fantastic.
It's the kind of thing that you would only have experienced in the past in kind of wild comedy films, possibly from the 30s, starring William Powell, or in the 70s, starring Steve Martin or something. You know what I mean? This can only be tongue-in-cheek. This is nobody lives a life this mad. You know, this scale just doesn't exist in the real world. Well, according to these lawsuits, it did exist.
It did.
And this is a man,
let's not forget, it was rumoured to be involved in the death of Tupac, wasn't he? That was a thing hanging over. In fact, there were various court cases, which is why he changed his name to P. Diddy. Everyone was going, oh, how hilarious, he's suddenly calling himself P. Diddy. A lot of that was to disassociate himself from the things that Puff Daddy had been accused of doing. And let's not forget that people were very defensive of R. Kelly, weren't they? And all the stuff about R. Kelly
has come out.
So it's the same thing. Everyone's keeping very quiet.
And so all the people who previously were absolutely couldn't wait to get invited to his latest white party are suddenly now keeping a very low profile. Of course, they now include everybody who was rich and fabulous in that world in the late 90s and the 21st century. You know, it was just absolutely everybody. You know, the notion that you wouldn't go to Puff Daddy's party if you were invited. It's just ridiculous.
Unthinkable.
They all absolutely went. It was all utterly unthinkable. And, you know, it's all more grist for the argument that the most bacchanalian, excessive point in the history of popular music was not the 70s, not the 60s, it was the 90s. It was the 90s, because that's when the money was there.
That was the absolute peak, wasn't it? Peak of earning.
Yeah, absolutely.
How many people are sitting there as we speak and working on a script about this? Because that is a movie you want to see, isn't it? And it's a movie that must be being made.
If a fraction of this turns out to be, you know, to make stick, this is going to make all your favourite pop music scandals from Jerry Lee Lewis in the 1950s through to I don't know what, it's going to make them look like complete non-starters. This is just staggering. The level of it, you know, I absolutely couldn't believe it. And of course, also what's tied up in this is he signed all these artists, didn't he?
Yeah.
To his label. All of whom were benefited massively from his patronage. You know, he promoted them very successfully. But then held on to the publishing, didn't he? And so a number of them have sued to get their publishing back. And some of them have got it back, but they've found that it's not worth anything like what they thought it was worth, because a huge amount of the revenue generated by those records went to the samples on which they were based. And so, you know, it's Every Breath You Take or whatever, you know. Is it I'll Be Missing You? And that was Every Breath You Take, I think it was. And, you know, so to get those records away, you have to be prepared to you know, pay off the people who own the original samples to get them to do it in the first place. You know,
when you've done that, there's not much left in the
pot. Not much left. So, you know, it's like we you know, we were talking about this the other week, and they're like the Phil Manzanera and his, you know, No Church in the Wild or whatever it was. You know, he ended up there, and we're, you know, Sting, and there's loads of others. They've probably done better out of it than anybody else at all. Because also that ties into the other thing that we're reading this week, which is, again, on the New York Times website, you can probably find this. It's a very interesting piece called What is a Song? Which was looking at the whole business of disputes about copyright around songwriting.
That's a fantastic piece. I've read that.
Yeah.
It, a really interesting point, which I didn't know. You probably did, actually, that in 1909, when these copyright laws were first established, the definition of a song was a piece of sheet music and the
lyrics.
Absolutely. But from 1978, it became the recording of that song, which is a completely different thing. There's far more in there that you could be accused then of nicking. So therefore, it's much easier to win a case if the song itself was, I mean, I suppose, were Ed Sheeran and Let's Get It On?
It's very complicated because, and that's the basis of the argument, you know. Can you steal a record? Everybody kind of understands the idea that you could steal a song because it's written down. Here's the lead sheet, you know. And so the case over Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On and whoever was supposed to have appropriated that, I can't even remember. The jury were not allowed to hear.
Out loud, wasn't it? Yeah.
Were not allowed to hear the Marvin Gaye version because that was too full of, you know, too full of Marvin Gaye. So what you could hear instead was a kind of a version of somebody just simply singing the sheet music. You know, so that's what the argument is about.
Yeah, the argument is about when does the composer's work end and the performer's work begin, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, you listen to Let's Get It On, you know, as a record. We all know that record, you know, 4 minutes worth or whatever it is. How much of that is the song? And how much of that is Marvin Gaye?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I would have thought it's 80% Marvin Gaye.
It is.
It's hardly a song at all. You know, you can't sit down and play that at piano. Nobody's gathering around the piano tonight going, tell you what, give us an old song. Why don't you do Let's Get It On, Grandma? Doesn't work.
I'll get the party started.
Just doesn't work. You know, it's Marvin Gaye. It's Marvin Gayeness, isn't it? You know, it's a brilliant vehicle for that, you know. And can you copyright that? I don't know. I don't know if you can do. So this one will run and run. But anyway, it's all there on the New York Times. You can no doubt find it online. What is a song? And if you know the answer, send us your answer on a postcard, please.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.